Now, as you remember, roughly speaking, we want to each fix our basics so that they are sort of in complex coordinates. So I could do that simply by looking for some H fix for the form delta X Z delta X C bar C bar. But it's actually a little bit convenient for now, not for the first 2 minutes, not to go to complex coordinates yet, but just to work in general coordinates.
So I want to describe the gauge fixing of the diffeomorphism invariance on the worksheet. We want to put the metric in complex coordinates, so that in complex coordinates is essentially the ZDZ bar. This means in complex coordinates to set HZZ and HZ bar Z bar to zero, which I can do with these delta functions. But if we want to work in general coordinates, which is also convenient to in order to figure out how to parameterize the different possible complex structures on the surface, it's better to just pick some reference metric. Some familiar reference metrics parameterized by whatever parameters I cannot get rid of by diffeomorphisms. Let me denote them just as some. Okay. We'll be more specific about their nature later. And say, okay, I want H to be the same as this up to a rescaling, a wire scaling. So a way I can impose that is that I can pick some auxiliary fields with a property that H tilde, that their trace with respect to the reference metric is zero. Okay. And then put a gauge fixing for the form okay. So it should be clear that this is going to kill all the parts of the metric which are not proportional to this reference metric. Okay. And then I can just build the rest of my ghost action as we did last week. So it still is going to be some reference metric. So by using diffeomorphisms, there is a theorem that we can make. We can always write, we can eliminate almost all the degrees of freedom of the metric up to while rescaling, up to just a finite number, which parameterizes the complex structure of the surface. So if you want, parameterize the way you glue your surface together by flat metric patches with holomorphic coordinate transformations. So to take into account the fact that we can have this. So it means that every metric can be reduced up to diffeomorphisms to some reference metric, which is characterized by this choice of complex structure. If I don't want to commit myself to a specific way of parameterizing these complex structures yet, I'll just take this family of reference metrics and leave it at that. And let me also put a. Let me write it in a way that is actually diffeomorphism invariant. Okay. Now, what sort of B and C ghosts we need to complete this into a nice object, nice action which has this topological symmetry. So last week we saw that we would add terms that look like the I, del A, I, C A, right? So we need to introduce a Gauss for every group symmetry that I want to get rid of, and an anti-Gauss for every another Gauss for every constraint. So in this case, it means that we're going to introduce some B, A B constraint this way, which are going to be the partners of this bosonic capital B's. We're going to introduce some CA, actually, CA, which are dual to the vector fields which define diffeomorphisms. So the Gauss action essentially looks like this. Because when I do a diffeomorphism, this changes by essentially A, CB. So F prime here, the AFI, is really the sort of the derivative. So you can sort of see that this action is going to be symmetric under some transformation which changes B, by capital B. And changes everything else, such as the metric. This way.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain how you came up with these actions? Like, what's the motivation?
I'm just writing down literally the bi fi plus bi af I ca that I discussed last week. This is literally the same. I think this is right. But you can also check that this action is indeed invariant under this sort of BSD symmetry. OK. So a nice feature of this action is that it's actually well invariant again. So the Gauss introduced in the Gauss is not spoiled. At least classically well invariant, and now we'll have to check if it's there quantum mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. No, delta C. Sorry. So actually, I call them Q. Sorry. Well, diffeomorphisms, not quite, because diffeomorphisms do not commute. And remember that QCA is in general supposed to be the natural constant. So in this case, I think this means something. I didn't write it down in my notes, so I'm reconstructing from memory. Don't fully trust me on this. It's probably something like this. I likely had to there might be some other terms where the contractions work the other way. It's a coefficient. Let me see, when I do a lead derivative to vector fields, right, so what do I do? What is the lead derivative of? I think this is supposed to be the derivative of V1A, dA, V2, B minus V2A, dA, V1B. So, and to parse exactly what this means, but yeah, I think it's likely to be this. Yes, thank you. Thank you. It should be needed to take care of this for the variation of the square root of G, I think. And of whatever part of the matrix is actually hidden inside this covariant derivative. So it actually, it's probably a little bit of a cumbersome calculation. But it's a good exercise in general relativity-like calculations. So, okay, this just to show essentially that this ghost action can be while invariant. It's far from, again, it's not completely obvious. When you do wild transformation, there are some terms that come out from the covariant derivative. And sometimes they come from square root of H. And they cancel each other if B is actually traceless, which I thought I'd written and I must have erased. So this is also another exercise. You probably have too many exercises, but time is what it is. So, okay. So now we've done things in sort of the general setup. We can just go study what happens locally. The first thing I want to understand is to check what is the wild anomaly for the ghosts to finally get that minus 26 that I've been promising you for a week now. So to do that, I want to go on the cylinder. Once I'm on the cylinder, I can just take my flat metric, go in compass coordinates, forget about all this general setup. So in complex coordinates, essentially my ghosts are B, ZZ, ZZ, B, Z bar, Z bar, C, Z bar. This is a conventional way to write them. And once they're written like that, the action becomes, so these are usually not just as B, and these are just not usually as C, and this is the conjugate variables. So the action is written as B del S bar see this bar, that's complex conjugate, is the ghost action. Okay. So it's just the thing over there. Written in complex coordinates. Perhaps the only point that deserves still being mentioned here is that so we get rid of the capital B field to impose our gauge fixing condition. So at some, you know, on occasion we will need to figure out what is the PRC transformation of our ghost. But because we got rid of the field capital B, we need to work a little bit harder. You don't need to do much harder. There is essentially a trick, which is the following. In principle, you could replace your e to the I B A B H A B with something like this. But this is just some constant. See, because the capital B field has zero, is Q closed, whenever you have a ghost action, you can add whatever function of B you want to it without changing anything. This is actually used very often in electromagnetism, where people use, essentially this corresponds to not having a delta function, but having a more complicated function of your gauge fixing condition, which still has the property that integrates to one along an orbit. It's like this mirrored version of your gauge fixing condition, or an averaging over many different gauge fixing conditions. The only reason this is useful is that now you can replace B's when you integrate it away with variation with respect to this eta. And put in front of everything. Now, what this eta is doing is essentially it's making your HZZ non-zero equal to eta. So if you turn on an eta ZZ, so essentially your BZZ can be replaced by del over del eta ZZ, which is just a change of the reference metric in which you turn on a little ZZ component. So this is essentially the same as inserting the stress tensor. Okay. So effectively, when we get rid of capital B, the BRC transformations would be amended to something like this. Which makes a lot of sense. The vanishing of T was the equation of motion for the metric. We got rid of the metric, but we don't want to get rid of the equation of motion for the metric. This is telling you that the equation of motion is actually Q exact. So it holds whenever you do things that are BST closed. Okay, so this is the action. Something else we can get out of the general expression, which is useful, is that we can get the stress tensor, the contribution of the ghosts to the stress tensor. Because the metric enters the ghost action, there will be a contribution to the stress tensor from the ghosts. If I write it in so classically, can be written like this. Okay? So this is it's the same spirit as we wrote the stress tensor for matter as -1/2 the x. Okay. So it's quadratic expression in the ghosts. You see, C behaves more or less like a vector field. B is as a two-component tensor. And T is a two-component tensor. Now, there is something else which is useful to consider. There is the system of ghosts that we've added have a nice symmetry, which is called ghost number. As you see, the action is invariant under the transformation which rotates B in one direction and C in the opposite direction. So the ghost number symmetry. So there is a current, there is a symmetry that rotates B and C in opposite directions, and there is a conserved current associated to this symmetry. And it can be written as simply CB. So this current has properties that are very similar to the current which we wrote for the free bosons. Okay. So this is associated to translations of the free boson. This is associated to rotations of the BC ghosts. But it has a crucial difference from this one. This current is anomalous. So the symmetry, ghost number symmetry, actually has an anomaly. And the ghost number symmetry is not quite conserved. Mm-hmm. Sure. So the ghost number symmetry sends C to C and B to minus B. It's a bosonic symmetry, nothing fancy. And the BST symmetry has charge 1 under this ghost number symmetry. So when I say this is anomalous, means again that the action is invariant under rotation under this transformation, but the measure is actually not. The measure, the B, the C, has just it almost goes back to itself, but it goes back to itself up to a phase, up to a scaling, which means that this current is going to be conserved up to some number that depends on this on your space, on the shape of your space, much like the trace of the stress tensor was not quite zero, but it was this. Now, I'm sorry. C is used both to denote the central charge and the C ghost. And I hope it won't be confusing. You know, usually, one is the Grassmann even, one the other Grassmann odd. So usually, it's pretty easy to figure out which one is talking about. For example, the left-hand side is Grassmann even. The right-hand side is Grassmann even. So that has to be the central charge. And for the ghosts, one can show something similar that sort of for the ghost number current that it is not quite zero, but is again proportional to the curvature of your manifold. Which means on the cylinder would be fine. But when we start studying nice worksheets, that would be interesting. OK, so how do we quantize this ghost system? Everything was pretty much classical until now. I will cut a few corners because we have only a week and a half left almost. Well, 2 weeks, kind of. But I will just do a Fourier expansion. Ah, well, one corner I should not cut. See, what are the equations of motions for the ghosts that come from this action? Well, they're just del bar B equal to 0, del bar C equal to 0. So B and C are holomorphic, classically. So if I expand them in modes, on the cylinder. Quantization will mean essentially proposing some anti-commutational relations for these modes. And the one that follows from this sort of first order action is very simple. Okay. So, roughly speaking, the meaning of this commutational relation is that if I do an equal time anti-commutator, I roughly get a delta function. So all of this is completely parallel to what we did for the boson, for the free boson. That's why I'm cutting a few corners. But most calculations can be done exactly the same way as we did the free boson calculations. Now, the first tricky point is to pick your vacuum. So when I want to build a Hilbert space for this Gauss, we're going to build it starting from some vacuum building up. There's a little bit of ambiguity. I mean, most modes have either positive or negative energy. So we can pick our vacuum to just kill by the modes that lower the energy, except for B0 and C0. B0 and C0 don't raise or lower the energy. The anti-commute to 1. So that means that actually the vacuum for the system of Gauss is degenerate. There is some ground state. Which, if you want this killed by all the positive modes, sorry, the negative modes, the positive modes of B. Sorry, I hope this is legible. And then from this one, I can build a second ground state by acting with C0. And vice versa, if you act with B0 on this guy, you go back to the other one. And then everything else can be built out of these states by acting with modes with which raise the energy. Now, although this is the most natural ground state for the system, it is the ground state for the Gauss on the cylinder, and it's also the state which naturally appears during quantization, meaning that if you start with a before gauge fixing with your theory in some ground state of the matter system. And then you introduce your Gauss. Your Gauss will end up sitting in this ground state, actually precisely this ground state. Now, a way to understand a little bit better the reason we had this C0 and B0 there is that the cylinder has diffeomorphisms which simply rotate it or translate it. These diffeomorphisms do not change the metric. Okay? So it means that the gauge fixing on the cylinder did not actually fix completely the diffeomorphisms. We are still left with these extra translations in time, which are actually infinite volumes, so they can get you some trouble. Now, so the existence of these extra diffeomorphisms that have been not being gauge fixed is directly connected to the existence of some zero modes for the Gauss. Now, when you try to define correlation functions on the cylinder, you need to somehow get rid of these extra diffeomorphisms, or at least make sure that you understand what effect do they have. So perhaps it's best to go back to the original to the original description of the gauge fixing, right? So I had this integral of the of some symmetric group or a B or the ghosts. Something like that. Now suppose that for some reason I wanted to get rid. I wanted to add some extra. I want to split this gauge fixing to something. Let me say this. Sorry. I suppose that there is some part of the symmetry that I want to sort of gauge fix separately from the rest. Okay, so there was some other there was the set of constraints that I want to use explicitly, and there was some other constraint I wanted to add to completely gauge fix the system. So it means I have some other some other gauge fixing condition. Now, I might decide to just do part of these integrals, just get rid of these conditions a bit by hand. So I could, for example, just do the integral, the Grassmann integral over the B tildes. Okay. That will just pull down something like that, an insertion of the C ghost. And then I can by hand do the B integral, say, and put a delta function of a tilde. Okay. So sometimes when there is a little mismatch between my gauge fixing conditions and whatever diffeomorphisms I'm actually using, these sort of mismatches can be dealt with by appropriate insertions in your path integral. So if you want to do some gauge fixing by hand afterwards, no, after you did your BST quantization, you can add your gauge fixing as long as you're accompanied by an appropriate ghost insertion. Okay. So the reason I mentioned it, unfortunately, sorry, this was one or two things that I was hoping to mention on Friday, and I didn't get a chance to. And I'm sorry that it has to be transplanted inside this lecture this way. So in order to study correlation functions on the cylinder, we also need some brass and we need some kets. Okay. So I define some G and G prime there, and there is some other dual states that I can define. And the one is naturally dual to this G. Is the one that will be killed by the CNs. Okay. But the one that has actually, so the non-zero inner product between the states, the only meaningful non-zero inner product in the states is this one. Okay. So pretty much because you want the thing on the left to be killed by everything which is not killed. Which does not kill the thing on the right, and vice versa. So here you want something that is killed by C0 and C0 bar, because they do not kill G. So to do that, I need to put by hand some C0 and C0 bar. Now in the context of gauge fixing, these are exactly the sort of insertions for these extra diffeomorphisms that translate or rotate the cylinder. So this by itself is just a statement in the quantization of the theory of Gauss. It has nothing to do with actual gauge fixing. I have this theory, I quantize it, and this is the only thing that makes sense. But in the context of the gauge fixing, this is intimately connected with the fact that there were some extra diffeomorphisms on the cylinder that had not been gauge fixed. So that your original integral wanted to be an integral over not all diffeomorphisms, but over all diffeomorphisms which act non-trivially on your metric. So you had to really put by hand a delta over your vector fields, over your coordinate transformations, which would kill the constant vector fields. So onto something like delta of constant vector fields. And this delta of constant vector fields is accompanied by the constant C, constant mod of the C Gauss. Notice all the equations I write here, I write for the holomorphic part, and then there are identical equations involving B bar and C bar. Okay. So every time I write something for the C and C and B, there are identical things written down for C bar and B bar. I'm so behind. Okay. Now it turns out that these ground states, although the most natural on the cylinder, are actually not very convenient for a lot of calculations. In particular, they're not invariant under BST symmetry. So if you act with the BST generator over these ground states, you don't get zero. To show this, I will have to write down the BST charge, which is a kind of a long expression, and I don't want to do that. But you see, there is a simple way to understand why. So we want this sort of things to be true, that the variation of B is the stress tensor. So if you want to think analogously to the free boson, we would like to consider some sort of state which is annihilated by all Ln's, and we get an equal minus one. This is also true for the free boson, for example. And because the BRST symmetry relates Bs and Ls, relates stress tensor and Big Ost, we want to, it's natural to consider a state which has a similar property under the action of the Bs. So it's natural to define some state zero, which is annihilated by all the Bs, including B minus one. And so this, you can write this zero, this state, simply as B minus one G. This automatically will be killed by B minus one. And then this is not going to be killed by C1 anymore. So it's going to be killed by the Cn for n greater than 1. So the standard, so the ground state can be written as C1, 0. Well, C1, C1 bar. So although we could do all the calculations we want in terms of these ground states, for future reference, it will be useful to do calculations instead using this as the reference state. The real reason will be clear only in a lecture or two when we start relating the cylinder calculations to calculations on the plane or on the sphere. But for now, just let's accept the fact that there is a useful state, zero. It's not a ground state, has a bit more energy than the ground state, but it's a nice feature that is actually killed by the BRST transformations. Okay. I'm sorry, it's difficult to give a completely linear path of thought because somehow the whole story is not completely linear. There are different, some of the choices are made so that things will work later. And it's difficult to, it's not always easy to justify them immediately. Hopefully by the end, things will be a bit more clear. But for now, this is a reasonable motivation. So for example, when we describe things like normal ordering, it will be with respect to this state. So let's start to define the stress tensor quantum mechanically now. So we do the point splitting. Yes.
Thinking about what you said here, that the delta function vector fields. So when we wrote the metric as that first line in the boards, because I can always do that up to diffeomorphism.
Yes.
But why choosing that type of, choosing to write a metric like this doesn't fix the whole symmetry that I have on the diffeomorphism.
Yes.
Why constant vector fields still there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're there.
They're always there, right? But if I write my metric in that way, it's like gaining fixing with respect to this diffeomorphism symmetry, right?
Yes.
Why doesn't it fix all
the? So essentially, it means this is not a complete gauge fixing.
Okay.
So there's still a little bit of gauge symmetry left. To get rid of it, we pretty much do it by, we can sort of do it by hand. Put by hand a delta function which restricts the integral over all coordinate transformations only to coordinate transformations which, well, I mean, you can do your choice in different ways, but roughly you want coordinate transformations which do not arise from this constant vector field. At least infinitesimally is a well-defined notion. And we really only care about things that are close to our gauge fixing condition anyway. So if I want to do that, I need to introduce an extra delta function. But this has, to do it properly, has to be accompanied by some Gaussian insertion. See, in a sense, because I have a slight mismatch between the B's and the C's, if you want. Because the B's were introduced B's only for the gauge fixing to the metric, but the C's are associated to the to the diffeomorphisms. So there are some C's which are not fixed by changes to the metric. So, okay, so we can give this definition. What happened? No. I don't know what happened to the front blackboard. So we can go through the same motions that we went through in the case of the free boson. And the result is that you can write it as normal ordering, which means the same expression minus the expectation value on the vacuum plus 13 over 12. Yes. This should be compared to the minus 1 over 24 that we found for the free boson. Now, at this stage, of course, it's still not clear why this has to do with the wild anomaly, right? I made a choice of vacuum, which is not even the natural one. So at the moment, it's just a number that happens to be 26 times the one for the free boson. If you want to really see the anomaly, I need to compute the Virasoro algebra. So I start with this definition. I take my modes. Or better, I start computing things like the commutator between the L's and C's, the commutator between the L's and B's, and then I use them to figure out what is the commutator between the L's and the stress tensor. And finally, I get the commutator between the L's. And the crucial point is that the central charge inside this commutator is minus 26.
Could you write the normal ordering of the Gradman variables?
Yes.
You define it in the usual way?
I define it like this. So I subtract the expectation value on this vacuum. But essentially I put to the right all the modes which kill this vacuum. Now again, you could ask me why didn't you do it with respect to the G vacuum? But
is there like a sign convention or something?
Sure, sure. So when you bring them across to each other to put them in the order you want, you put minus signs. So, okay, so doing these calculations is possible. With Mathematica, you can do it in 2 minutes. By hand, it's a little bit tedious. But the end point is this. So this shows you that if you want to do bosonic string theory, you need to put together 26 free bosons describing your spacetime and the ghosts. Together give you zero central charge for your stress tensor and make it so the thing makes sense. For example, Q square equal to zero only holds if there are 26 bosons. Now, today, yeah, I mean, I've written down the calculation for the. Well, I think today, rather than trying to go through these steps, which are really not particularly illuminating, I would like to discuss a bit more the properties of this ghost number current. Which disappeared from the board. Ah, over there. Okay. So again, we can define it by point splitting. This way. And then you can start computing things about it. For example, you can compute the expectation value on this vacuum. So you will find that this is the same as the sort of normal order definition. Minus 3/2. So what does it mean? It means that this state has ghost number minus 3/2. Has charge minus 3/2 under the rotations which rotate C with charge 1 and B with charge minus 1. The ground state has ghost number minus 1/2. And because we get it from here by acting with C1. Notice there are two independent ghost numbers. One is acting on the C, B, and C, and the other on B bar and C bar. So I'm just referring to the one which acts on C and B. Then if I act with another C, to get the other ground state, I get plus 1/2. Okay. So you see that the definition of at least things make sense, right? There is a sort of a symmetry in the definition between the of C of G and G prime. Similarly. The dual state also has charge minus 1/2, which should help understand why this is what makes sense. See, if this is charge minus 1/2 and this is charge minus 1/2, it's better have charge 1. Mm. Now, so as I mentioned, the Gauss number current is actually conserved in flat space. So as long as you're on the cylinder, you're fine. But things get interesting if there is a bit of curvature. Now, or if you want to get interesting under Weyl transformations. So to see that, it's useful to compare the definition of the current we gave in some coordinate system with the definition of the currents we might give in some other coordinate system. So if I try to use the exact same definition but in a different coordinate system, right, I'm going to subtract something slightly different. Because I'm going to subtract something like this. I mean, suppose I have some other coordinate system as tilde of S. Perhaps I should write it like this. So the difference between the things I subtract in one coordinate system and ones I subtract in another coordinate system is this expression. This expression is finite, but it's not zero. If you take the limit as S prime goes to S, you get a finite answer, which, sorry, my bad. B and C themselves transform in an interesting way when I do coordinate transformations, because they had, I mean, one had a upper index, the other had two lower indices. So actually, under coordinate transformations, you get some rescaling of this and this. So the things I should really compare are not this, but actually this coming from the B transformation. And this coming from the C ghost. So the C ghost transforms like a vector field, so in the opposite way as the current dx that we saw, while B transforms with twice the second power of the factor which you associate to the current, because there's two lower indices. So if you do this limit, you get minus 3/2 the S squared S tilde over the S tilde. So these factors are definitely important in determining what is the final answer. May ghosts have been different types of objects, then the answer here would be different. So for example, if instead of having this sort of, instead of being ghosts, right, so instead of being fancy Grassmann-odd objects with bosonic spin like this, it had been more standard things like fermions, just free fermions, then these factors, these powers would have been different. Most of the formula would have looked pretty much the same here. The formula would have been the same if B and C's were just fermions, free fermions. But here you would have had something like a 1/2 and a 1/2, and you would have gotten just zero. So if you have free fermions, the current that rotates them is just perfect, well behaved. But when you have these ghosts, which have this sort of peculiar space-time indices, you get these more interesting results. Well, B has to behave like your metric because you use the metric to gauge fix. I mean, B has to behave like capital B. And also, at the end, because of this relation to the stress tensor, we want it to behave like a stress tensor. So it has the same kind of indices we use for stress tensor. And C has to be similar to vector fields. So actually, right, if you notice, so originally we put the index of C low and indices of B up. But so what we're calling here CZ is pretty much the same as a CZ bar. And so on. But this particular choice, so we raise and lower the indices so that the final action is simple in these complex coordinates. OK, so starting from this and from this sort of relations, you can keep playing around, and you can find what the commutation relation is between L's and J's. The Fourier modes of the Gauss current. So see, the current transforms much like the current we found for the boson. Remember, it was commutation ratio was ln am equal to minus m am. But there's an extra term, a central term, a number, which pops out in some of the commutation relations. And because the stress sensor controls how correlation functions change as you change the metric, because of this extra term here, the behavior of the current is going to be somewhat unexpected when you change the metric. So in particular, you can compute something, for example, like this. Sorry, when I put the 0 here, I really meant C0, C0 bar. Sorry. Now, the conservation of the current is sort of holomorphic coordinates. It's just the same that del S bar JS is 0. Okay. And as before, in the presence of a stress tensor, this fails at the location of the stress tensor. The derivative of this is going to give me a delta function. So if I use my stress tensor to just make a change in the metric, on the cylinder, I'm going to find a violation of the conservation law, which is roughly, you know, 3 times the curvature, if you do things properly. And this tree will be rather important in what follows. So for example, if I walk on a sphere, the Gauss current, Gauss number current will be conserved, will fail to be conserved by 3, and so on. So it means that if I look at the operators I place on a sphere, I have to have three more C's than B's if I want to have something that makes sense and is non-zero, and so on. OK, so now I think we have accumulated all the tools that we need to do a calculation of almost all the tools. We need to start computing scattering amplitudes of strings. So we have our ghosts, we have our scalar fields. We understand them rough, more or less on a cylinder. So next, we have to understand how to have these cylinders come together into a smooth surface, and how to compute the amplitude for that process.